So welcome everyone to the Monday night, Dharma night. Dharma night, the Auckland Buddhist Center. So we're starting a new theme tonight. It's going to be the Wheel of Life. And we're going to have a series of, I think about 6 or 7 talks on this. And this is the introductory talk tonight. So I'm gonna be opening out the theme. So I guess to start with, I'm probably gonna take kind of quite a slightly unconventional way in to the Wheel of Life theme. I just finished teaching a course on the Wheel of Life on Wednesday nights. So the kind of the Dharma theory behind it feels almost a bit, sometimes I get a bit bored, you know? It's just like I've kind of looked at it. But I think actually the approach I'm going to take tonight might actually work, which would be great. Yeah, so maybe it's not boredom, but just the benefit of maybe some digestion on my part. So I'd like to start by telling you or talking to you about a play. I really like plays, and I didn't used to like plays. It wasn't really until I moved to the UK and moved to Cambridge and started working at Windhorse Trading, which was a Buddhist right livelihood business in the Triratna, that I started going to Shakespeare plays. And in Cambridge, they do Shakespeare on the Park with students, and they've always got one really good actor, and then kind of a student support. And I guess I really started going while I was there. And also, the Cambridge Theater, they used to get really good people coming through because England's got a good tradition of acting. And they would sell $5 tickets for the whole year. So I'd always buy tickets for any play I thought was good, and I'd just buy two $5 tickets just like 12 months in advance. And $10, you can't really go wrong, can you? And so I got to see a lot of plays, and one of the plays I really liked, but also was Chekhov's Cherry Orchard. Has anybody ever seen the Cherry Orchard here? Yeah? Few? All right. So I'm going to ruin it for you and tell you the plot, the narrative and what happens. So the Cherry Orchard set in Russia. And Chekhov is a Russian playwright, by turn of the century. And the setting is that there's this cherry orchard, and you just kind of, the play opens out with a family coming into this house, and they open the windows, and they let the air through, and I think this is how it starts, I have to admit. I haven't seen it in about 10 years, but this is at least how it starts in my memory. And they open out the house, and you realize that there's a matriarch of the family, and she's actually not that old. She's probably in her 30s, you know, back in those days, which was, you know, into adulthood. But she's obviously rich. She's very beautiful. She's very educated, and she kind of breezes through. And there's staff. They bring staff with them. There's some locals that come out that knew them, because it turns out that her father had owned this cherry orchard, and it was a house there. And they'd come there every springtime, and they'd vacation and spend the summer there. And she just starts to reminisce about all the lovely memories she has of the cherry orchard, and she's sharing the memories with some of the staff that they brought with them, and some of her nieces and nephews, and I think there's an uncle or an aunt there, and it's just quite joyous. But as the place keeps unfolding, you realize that she's under a lot of pressure, because she can't afford to pay the taxes on the cherry orchard, and so she's going to lose it. And she's in a real state of despair over the fact that this orchard's going to get lost, and this house has to be sold, and there's no way she can save it. Such a big part of her childhood, such a big part of her psyche, really, and she can't save it. But there is a young, another man who's slightly younger than her, probably, you know, 5 years younger than her, or similar age maybe, who lives in the city, the town near there. And he's not aristocratic. He grew up there, and he's part of the new generation of Russians who are merchants and capitalists and who are developing the city. So it's not the aristocracy. And he loves her. Yeah, he loves her. And he's got this idea that all she really has to do is give up part of the cherry orchard. She just sells a part of it. Yeah. And the part she sells then is turned into housing. And the sale from the housing will secure the property forever. Yeah. But the only thing is that she would lose part of the orchard, and she can't do it. And she just kind of can't see it. She can't see him. She can't see the promise. And in a way, she's blind to that possibility. And in the cherry orchard, there's other people that are in similar predicaments. So there's a young guy who's very educated, well-to-do, might be one of her sons or a nephew, I can't really remember. But he's chasing this really coquettish young woman who's also there. Yeah, and he's trying to find love, and he's got this idea of love, and he really loves, he's fallen in love head over heels with this woman who's just flittering kind of out of his range. And if I remember correctly, she's chasing something else, yeah? And he's chasing her. And there's a woman who's actually quite, quite a bit more homely and a bit more grounded and down to earth that loves him, yeah? And everybody in this play is chasing something they can't have. And what's right on their tail is something they could have if they only turned around and would kind of be not so fixed about what they want. And as I was following this play, I just thought it was so dharmic. I just thought it was highly, highly dharmic that the way in which kind of we go around in circles chasing after the things we want. And always thinking they'll give us something, but never being able to kind of grasp that satisfaction, you know? And while at the same time, you know, what the Dharma's saying at least is what would really bring satisfaction is right here if we just turned around and looked at it. So in some ways, Chekhov's Cherry Orchard is a window into the futility of human existence and the human condition from a certain perspective. The very end of the play, this old guy who's just been trying to keep up the plot the whole time, he's always a step behind, gets locked in the house. You know, they're kind of talking to one another. It's like, oh, well, you know, if we remembered everything, absolutely, yes. This is the last time. Oh, well, goodbye, orchard, goodbye, house, lock it up. And then he kind of rolls out the back room and he's like, hello, is anybody here? And I guess he represents kind of that loss, really, you know, kind of some wisdom or some experience that just gets lost. I don't know. But with respect to Cherry Orchard, it just sort of touched something for me. And I don't really know if Chekhov touches a lot of people in the same way that Shakespeare does, for example. But what can happen with really good plays is that you see yourself in the play, or you see part of life in the play. It's also the same with good literature and good music. It sort of engages us because it reflects in a way part of how our life is or part of how our life's gone. Shakespeare's Hamlet's always been a really strong play for me. Whenever I see it, it's just really kind of, I leave just really quiet. I leave really quiet, and I leave just needing to kind of digest what I've just seen. And, it's interesting. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience here with that particular play, but, you know, I mean, maybe it's personal, but for some reason, that play is also, it must have touched a lot of people's lives because it keeps going through time. And it's such a powerful drama about the human condition that they can even put it in a different period. So they don't have to set it back in Denmark. You know, they can set it, you know, in California. You know, they can set it in New York City. They can set it anywhere they want, and it'll still work. I was thinking about another Shakespeare play, which is really good, which is called Much Ado About Nothing. It's a very, very good comedy, and it's about Beatrice and Benedick. And these two, they actually, Benedick is kind of like a bit of just a lad. And Beatrice is this really kind of very intelligent woman who's almost so intelligent at a time when women needed to be more docile. So she hasn't managed to find herself kind of a husband. And the interesting thing about Much Ado About Nothing, though, is that they actually don't like each other. Yeah? And there's a bit of a lull in the narrative, the overarching narrative of the play, because there's a wedding about to happen. But they've got a week or so. The wedding's not going to happen. So the characters decide that they'll matchmake between Beatrice and Benedick. And in this matchmaking is hilarious because, in a way, the two start not liking each other. But then when they start hearing these other people tell them how much the other loves them, they start questioning kind of their feelings towards that person. Yeah. And in the end, of course, they fall madly in love with one another. Yeah. And it's really interesting because it sort of questions... sort of, you know, well, why do we like what we like? You know, is it just arbitrary? And how can we be so fickle that when someone else tells us that something likes us or someone likes us, then all of a sudden we start to like them more, you know? So once again, it's just kind of, it's, I guess in a way, it's exploring preference in a very comedic way, and it's exploring the human predicament. I think we can all sort of, well, I don't know, I can kind of see myself in that a little bit, not completely, but so I think all of those, you know, Much Ado About Nothing, Hamlet, and The Cherry Orchard are all attempts to capture kind of the somehow the pattern of human life. And I think the reason why they can speak to people and the reason why they continue through time is because they kind of capture that pattern successfully. So in the Buddha's day, he had two disciples that were his main disciples. It was Sariputra and Moggallana. And Sariputra and Moggallana were very good friends. And early on, as they were youngsters, they decided that they would try and find the truth, try and find the spiritual path, and kind of went different ways, but agreed to come and find the other if they ever found it. And in a way, that's how they one of them found it. I forget who it was, maybe Sariputra, and then he told Moggallana. Then they both went to see the Buddha and gained enlightenment and became, you know, the chief disciples of the Buddha. Sariputra was known for his ability to control his mind, and in particular to drop into dhyanic states and to, I think, preach the Dharma to some extent, teach the Dharma. But Moggallana was known for different things. Moggallana was much more of a, what we call these days, a people person. So Moggallana could mind read, was what I read today. Someone said he could mind read. But I don't think it's so fair to say that he was a mind reader. I think it's more fair to say that he was a karma reader. Yeah? He could kind of tell what people's inclinations were karmically. Which is, I understand, I could see why you could say that's mind reading. So if somebody's kind of prone towards anger, or prone towards greed, or prone towards envy, or prone towards being competitive, or prone towards kind of dismal thinking, or, you know, in pain and suffering, Moggallana could see that. He could see it, and he could explain to the person in very kind of easy ways the person could understand what their predicament was and how to get out of it. And Moggallana's abilities were symbolized or crystallized in the image of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. At least that's the story I've heard, which is the image right up here. So it's a circle, which has got multi layers of symbolism in it, and clutching it is the wheel or the demon of impermanence. And at the very hub of the wheel is a cock, a crow, and a pig, symbolizing, not in that order, greed, hatred, and delusion. So, and that's the hub. It makes the whole thing go round. So when Moggallana, his insight into the human condition was put in this form. So probably today we wouldn't do that. Probably today we'd make a short video clip or a blog page or, you know, maybe, I don't know.
Maybe
an installation. Yeah, installation. Or we do Twitter feeds. We make an app. Yeah. Yeah. So you need a bit of translation to move this symbol, which comes from 2,500 years ago, to the modern day. But the fascinating thing is that the symbol, like Shakespeare's plays, have kept having relevance for people all through that time. Yeah. So we can trust that something in it has been working for people. Whether it'll work for us or not, I don't know, but we'll find that out over the next 5 weeks as we unpack it a bit more. When it comes to how you can use something like this, I was thinking of a similar sort of classification system, which is different, but it's the Myers-Briggs personality categories, yeah? So you've got the idea of an introvert, extrovert, sensing, intuitive type, feeling, thinking, and judging or perception. And so those four pairs, you kind of judge yourself out on that, and you kind of see what you are and kind of where your leaning is. So it's very interesting because you're not really like 100% extrovert or 100% introvert. There's a really, really good book called Quiet, which I know has been on the market for a long time now. But if you haven't read it and you're interested in kind of introversion and extroversion, the book's written by a lawyer who is an introvert. And basically, as an introvert, she struggled with everybody telling her, or society telling her too, that she needed to be an extrovert. And so she just explored what it means to be an introvert. And what she finds in that is that actually it's not so black and white. People aren't just introverts or just extroverts. You do have big tendencies. And definitely you need to go with kind of, you know, what you, you know, you have to honor kind of how you are. But, you know, it's not 100%. I think I judge out at like 60-40. I think I'm 60%, 50% introvert, other extrovert. But it's really interesting because I'm kind of balanced. Whenever I tell people that, they think, no way. You know, they say, I'm an extrovert. But I think actually it's right. I think I am an introvert. I think I am an introvert. But I think what I am is I'm an Ohioan. And I'm an American. Did you guys just say that? Yeah. So compared to other cultures, I appear like an extrovert. And it was interesting because in this book, Quiet, she did find that the supposedly all the New World countries, like Australia, America, New Zealand, were populated by extroverts because it's the extroverts that left the country. It's the introverts that stayed there. And they think that there's genetic connections. It's interesting, isn't it? So that's one thing. I think the other thing about the Myers-Briggs was I remember thinking about judging versus perceiving types. I am extremely high judging type. I think I'm like 90% judging type. I am not very perceiving at all. And perceiving types drive me batty, yeah? A perceiving type is always kind of opening things out, always, well, this is how I understand it, always looking at what's possible, always kind of exploring, always trying to kind of see what could happen. Yeah? Judging types are always trying to close everything down and to come to a conclusion, crystallize, you know? And I'm very much like that, you know? It's to be working with someone who's constantly opening things out when I'm constantly closing things down is extremely frustrating for both of us. So when I kind of started to see that pattern, then I could work with it more. I could sort of see I could see when people were opening things out. I could see when people were trying to explore in that way. And I could see when I had a tendency to close things down and I could act differently. Yeah. So it actually meant that I was more effective working with other people. I understood myself better and I understood other people better. And the third one I was going to say was the feeling thinking continues to be an interesting exploration for me because I'm also pretty much thinking type. Yeah, pretty strong thinking type. And, you know, I've never understood feeling types. It's like, I'm working at it. I really am. But feeling types are interesting. They just love you or don't love you. You know, it's like for me, well, either way, I'm not going to go into it. Yeah, but I've worked really hard at trying to understand why someone's a feeling type or how feeling type kind of operates, and you know, and also trying to develop that side of myself, which is why I'm so interested in the Brahma Viharas as a practice and the Metta Bhavana. But when it comes to the Wheel of Life, the Wheel of Life is slightly different than the Myers-Briggs types, because the Myers-Briggs typology, the categorizations, it's not like right or wrong. If you're a feeling type or a thinking type, you know, you're not right or wrong being in one of those two camps. They're both right. They're just different emphases. Whereas with the Wheel of Life, actually what the Wheel of Life is talking about is ways that in which we get stuck. Yeah? So they're almost like, you could think of patterns or lifestyles, but I was thinking the word I really liked is mind styles. You know, they're like mind styles that we get into, sort of like kind of ways of thinking about the world and ways of being and ways of responding to the world, which are kind of characteristic. And what they are is subpar. You know, they're so much less than what's possible. And I guess that's what Moggallana wanted to help, was he had insights into karma and rebirth, understood as the situations we make for ourselves. He had insights into this, and he wanted to help us to move away from dissatisfaction and dukkha, which is the Buddhist word for suffering, or the chariot wheel that is ill-fitted and kind of just keeps bumping every time it goes around. Yeah, because life can be like that. And so what Moggallana was talking about was different kind of mind styles that we get into, different ways of living and ways of seeing life and acting in life, which are to our own detriment. And he kind of identified six in total, but two of them were relatively pleasant or not too rough. The human realm is kind of a balance of pleasure and pain. The God realm is definitely the realm of pleasure. But since the God realm is the realm of pleasure, it's also the realm of complacency. Yeah? And there were four painful realms. The Asura realm, which is the realm of competitive envy. And then there's the animal realm, where it's just basic gross pleasures. You just kind of hedonic pleasure, just satisfying the senses. And then there's the hungry ghost realm, where you just can never get sustenance. You can never feed yourself. You know, whatever you take in is never enough. You know, there's no satiation of hunger. You just hungered. And that's what you're always in a state of hunger. And then the hell realm, you know, which is a realm of intense pain such that you just narrow down into that pain and just really can't see anything around you. So you've got those six realms, and I think what Mogalyana wanted us to do with those realms, like with the Myers-Briggs, is he wanted us to start to think, really, about how to get out of these realms. He wanted to help us to understand these sides of ourselves. Now, chances are you're going to go into these different realms at different times of your life. You may even go through them at different times of your day. I know that just recently I was having a really kind of flat period, just mood-wise, over the winter, and I really didn't know what it was, but you know, it was a really, really flat mood, and I don't normally have that. So, you know, I had to remember during that you know, like in the hell realm, when you're experiencing pain, Your one desire is just to alleviate the pain. You just want out. You just want it to end. It's that simple. And I know the Dharma tells me otherwise. The Dharma tells me that rather than kind of just focusing on my own pain or my own predicament and kind of sorting it out, that I need to keep practicing ethics. And ethics involves an awareness of others. And it's actually getting out of the hell realm can be so simple as to perform generous acts, to expand your state of consciousness beyond the self-centeredness. So you can, you can try and see these states in yourself. Also drop a lot into envy, to be honest. I get very competitive. I mean, Vajrajyoti wouldn't know that because she doesn't see that side of me ever. But you know, I can be very, very competitive. And it's interesting with the competitive nature, because you know what this wheel is telling us is that you're looking for the fruits, but you're not actually putting the groundwork in, the conditions by which the fruits would arise. You just want what people have, but you don't want to kind of build it yourself. And it's just interesting, when I get in that state, I just have to see it. When I see it and have a perspective on it, then I can let go of it more. So what we've got coming up is we're going to explore the Wheel of Life, and we're going to start by having a talk from Vajrajyoti. And Vajrajyoti is just going to talk to us about it's a really significant topic, the whole topic of conditionality, the whole topic of the Buddhist view of things rising and things falling away. You know, the Buddha's initial insight into the nature of reality, the thing he really saw was that things arise on the basis of conditions, and when those conditions aren't there, they cease to arise. And he applied that insight to the human predicament. So in the next week, Erica is going to give us a talk about karma. And karma is an exploration of conditionality from the perspective of the individual. And then on the week following that, Helen's going to give us a talk on the six realms, which are the six mind styles that you can drop into. And on the week after that, we're actually going to have quite a joyful Monday night, that Monday. Amaradipa is going to talk on just sort of that point of freedom where you move from being stuck on this wheel to a more meaningful path, which is the whole unfolding of the Buddhist path off of this wheel of life. And that's really what Mogalyana was trying to get people onto. He wanted people to get off the wheel, even the relatively enjoyable human realm. Yeah, he wanted to get them off the wheel and onto the spiritual path. So she's going to be talking about the spiral path, the spiritual path, and the choice she just made to join the order. She was just ordained earlier this year. But on that same night, we've also got Natalie coming back. And so in the second half of the evening, we'll have a welcome back for Natalie, which should be great. So Natalie has just made that choice. Well, she's actually, to be honest, she's getting ordained today. Isn't that right? Yeah. So she'll have gotten ordained today probably by now. Who knows? It might be in the evening. And she would have gotten her new name. And for the next week, only she knows it, her and her private preceptor. And it'll be secret to everybody else. But next Saturday, I think, is the public ordination. So, and then after Amaradeepa's and Natalie's evening, the last evening we're going to have is we're going to explore the topic of what is enlightenment. And we've actually got two people visiting from the UK. We've got a guy named Artha Dasa, who was ordained this year at Guyaloka, which is the men's retreat center in Spain, and also Artapriya, who's a public preceptor in the UK, and they're visiting for a month to run some retreats and just visit. But I asked Artha Dasa to give the talk on what is enlightenment. So that'll be really good, because he's someone we don't know, so maybe that'll kind of like help with the mystery of it. I don't know. But that'll be the last evening, and that'll round out the series. And I think in order to make this fruitful, I know that it's difficult to come every week. I know people kind of, although some of you do come every week. But with this topic, if you do want to take this topic a bit deeper, if you want to make something of it, well, come every week. Yeah? And reflect on the wheel of life yourself. Yeah? Reflect on the topics that are brought up. You can find out on the internet what the topic is that's coming up. Reflect on it a little before. After you've listened to the talk, reflect on it a bit afterwards. Buddhism was never meant to be theoretically studied. Buddhism was always meant to be put into practice. And what Moggallana was really doing was just trying to hold up a mirror so that the guys, well, I assume they're mostly guys he was talking to be honest, but the people he was talking to could just sort of see what the situation they were in. And he wanted to explain it in such a way that they could see through it and make changes such that their lives became more meaningful and more happy. So if we kind of don't reflect on this topic, and a topic like the Wheel of Life comes up every 2 years here at the center, so some of you have probably already kind of explored it once or twice, three times maybe. For some of the old lags, probably about six times or eight times. But the beauty about Buddhism is that you can keep going deeper, but the depth is not in it's not in a kind of a more sophisticated understanding of the words. It's because somehow you've reflected such that the words actually start to resonate with your experience. You know, you really feel them kind of true. You see the truth of them in the world around you. And if you really had insight into the Wheel of Life, you wouldn't have an additional vocabulary. You know, that's not what it would be. It would be that you, when you use the word like in the hell realm, you actually know from your own experience kind of what that situation's like, and you understand that mind style. You know, you understand it, and you got a bit of an insight into it, such that because you understand it, you don't get caught in it anymore. You know, personally, you don't get caught in it. And perhaps, if you're lucky, you understand it well enough that you can describe it to other people so that they don't get caught in it either. So, over the next 6 weeks, that's what we're going to be exploring. And we've got a little bit of time, probably 10 minutes or so. So if anybody's got any questions, we can field them.